WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. The U.S. Navy plans to rename some ships. CBS's Eleanor Watson on one of them.
Documents obtained by CBS News show proposals to, during the month of Pride, change the name of USNS Harvey Milk, which recognizes the slain gay rights leader and Navy veteran.
The family of the Boulder, Colorado firebombing suspect is in federal custody. Homeland Security Secretary Christine
We're also investigating to what extent his family knew about this horrific attack, if they had any knowledge of it, or if they provided support to it.
12 people were injured in Sunday's attack, some seriously. Senate Republicans race to overcome divisions on what President Trump calls his big, beautiful budget bill. Senate Majority Leader John Thune says the bill
will be something that will make this country more safe and people in this country more prosperous.
Former special government employee Elon Musk calls the bill a disgusting abomination. The White House says those words change nothing. CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Packers back at practice. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports in Green Bay, where the Packers OTAs continue here at Lambeau Field. Anthony Belton is the Packers' second-round pick out of NC State, competing for a spot on the offensive line. I asked him if he's been more nervous or excited to be in the NFL.
It's a little bit of both, because, you know, you're nervous because, you know, you're in a new environment around people you're not really too familiar with. But also, it's like you're excited because this is what you've been wanting to do since you was a kid, lifelong dream. You get a chance to keep playing the game you've been loving since a kid. It's like, it's a blessing. But you're going to be nervous at first a little bit.
Baseball, the Brewers and Reds series continues tonight in Cincinnati. Milwaukee winning 3-2 last night, thanks to another home run by Christian Yelich, named National League Player of the Week. Yelich, hit by a pitch Sunday, still managed to hit his sixth home run in the past 10 games.
He crushed two balls tonight that, you know, sore hand or not, he's living up to his Player of the Week, you know, outstanding.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy with Sports on Mike Clemens.
A game without a crowd is just a scrimmage. A performance without an audience is just a rehearsal. Without your presence, high school sports and the performing arts aren't possible. Ensure that these essential extracurricular activities continue to enrich the lives of students in Wisconsin. Purchase a ticket to your local high school's game or performance.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Full Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I want to start off with Maryland Governor Wes Moore's statement. If Trump can do so much bad in such a small amount of time, why can't we do so much good? Now is the time for us to be impatient too. And yes, somebody gets it. Somebody gets the idea that if they can destroy something, why can't we build something? And now it's going to take a little longer to build because any idiot with, as my grandfather always said, any idiot with a hammer can tear down a house, and we're watching our idiot tear down our house. He would say it takes a skilled craftsman to build a house. But I think we can build a better house. And we're going to have to go through what is this nightmare at this point. And I've been saying it from the beginning of this term, in fact, since election night, that the solutions that we need are going to come out of the suffering caused by their savagery. So as they're doing all of these horrible things, as they're gutting Medicaid, as they're giving massive tax cuts to rich people, as they're undoing everything Biden did to help reshore manufacturing, create jobs, rebuild our infrastructure. As they're undoing that stuff, it's up to us to go, hey, there's a better way. And I like what Wes Moore's saying. Look, you know, at the end of the day, we can act. We can act fast. And maybe now is this time to start building some of the ideas for the future. And that's what I've been saying all along. And, you know, because here's the thing. I look at what, you know, has come out the last week or so. And I've been saying since, you know, last election cycle, you know, Trump is going to make patronage great again. And basically, here we go, straight out of Project 2025 era rhetoric. Another promise of a better government looks a lot like a loyalty test. The latest federal hiring plan, just rolled out by the Trump folks, isn't just bureaucratic tinkering around the edges. This is a full-on absolute blueprint for making your next paycheck dependent on your political allegiance. And look, one can't make this up. Federal job applicants are now going to be quizzed on their favorite Trump administration policy. That's right. You heard it right. The quiz, you know, what's your favorite executive order? Want to work for the government? Brush up on Donnie's EOs. And then in essay form, which, yeah, good luck. Explain how you will advance them. You know, doing any of the millions of jobs that our federal government does, you who has to clean the, you know, the offices, tell me which is your favorite executive order and how you're going to help empty those trash cans and move the agenda. Because, you know, forget your resume, forget what skills you bring to the table, forget that education you went and got, forget any expertise you may have. What matters most now, you got MAGA in the blood? Is MAGA flowing through your veins? This new hiring scheme, crafted by Trump domestic policy head Vinny Haley and acting OPM director Charles Ezel. Now look, they talk a big game about efficiency and patriotism and all that, but scratch the surface and what you smell is a whole lot of BS and what looks like a loyalty test in disguise. This is bureaucratic gatekeeping by ideology at its finest. Government jobs turned into political favors. Yeah, we've seen that before, right? Maybe? History? Anybody? And if all this sounds familiar, it should. It's how cronyism works. It's how it works in a banana republic or in fascistic regimes. This is not democracy. This is not a democracy that claims to represent all of we the people. Now, their policy does bans racial quotas, bad, bans preferences, bad, and ends the collection of workforce demographic data. Again, this administration's war on data should freak everyone out. Those are sold as, you know, basic fairness. We're just pushing for fairness. But to be honest, to be real, this is a calculated measure to erase equity. This isn't an effort to level the playing field or any of that. This is a part of a wider purge of diversity, equity, and inclusion under the banner of we're just restoring American values. And you go, translation? Back to the days when hiring looked a lot like hiring your buddies and only your buddies or people who looked a lot like you? Even worse, OPM wants to make religious colleges and homeschool networks their new recruiting hotspots. Yay! Meanwhile, again, back to the war on data, the data that tracks the how representative the federal workforce is of the rest of us, well, it's gone. Out of sight, out of mind, done. And are we surprised? No, not surprised at all. This is who they are. Look, you don't have to be a policy expert to see where this is heading. We've seen it in workplaces where managers hire their kind and skip over people who are more qualified just because they don't share their vision. Now imagine the kind of favoritism system, the kind of favoritism system wide all across our government, where your political beliefs become your passcode, where dissent is actually disqualifying. Not whether you're good or bad at your job, just as long as you know which side of the bread your butter's on. And look, plenty of working class folks rely on these federal government jobs, not just for the services, but for the jobs. They are some of the last decent paying, stable jobs with health insurance and pensions and, you know, maybe a shot at the middle class. But if your politics don't line up just right, if you're not quoting Donnie's executive orders and pledging your allegiance to dear Donnie, to dear leader, you're out. Interestingly enough, one human resource official put it plainly, this whole plan is going to make it harder to hire, not easier. And as the process gets more complicated and more political, who gets hurt by it? It's working people. It's people like you and I, especially folks who don't have connections, who aren't part of the big party machines. They're going to be left behind. And then think of all the qualified people who are now going to have to be forced to sit down and write essays proving they're patriot, they're patriotic enough. Wear their patriotism on their sleeve just to get a job. You know, good work ethic, clean background? Nah, never mind. How loyal to dear leader are you? The reality is we should be building a civil service that reflects all of us. Not a political army loyal to one egomaniac, insecure leader. If we're turning job interviews into ideological litmus tests, then the real job being offered isn't public service, it's servitude. And understand, patronage in this country, it's got deep roots. You go back to the 1820s and Andrew Jackson and the spoils system. Yep. The spoils go to the victor, which means I get to put whoever I want. And what did it lead to? Widespread corruption, inefficiency, a government that did nothing for people. I don't know. Sounds like where he wants to take us. Throughout the 19th century, we saw, you know, anyone who took any history course learned about New York's Tammany Hall and how they used patronage to maintain their power. And you go, but Rick, you know, that's a long time ago. You know, Garfield got shot by a disgruntled office seeker. And, you know, they passed the Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act of 1833, did away with it, began merit-based hiring. And you go, yeah, the federal government did. States kind of far behind. But where are we now? We still have some form of it. Wealthy individuals and institutions support their kind. We've got a government right now that political appointments, campaign fundraising, lobbying networks, there's a ton of favoritism there. Now, what Speaker Mike Johnson would say is, well, you know, Trump's doing it right out in the open. He's being honest about his criming. He's being open about his rigging of the system. The question that I have is this is what we want? Because understand, my red-headed friends, at some point, dear Donnie goes away and you end up with someone else. Maybe someone like Wes Moore, who's saying, hey, we can do good things fast too. And maybe we get somebody who goes, I'm going to take all these things that Trump used for bad and maybe we'll do it for good. I don't know. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are we ready for patronage? Are we ready to beg for our jobs? Loyal and kiss the ring? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So in April, we have the Grand Liberation Day. Tariffs for everyone.
And look, you know, a lot of back and forth, a lot of people, you know, this is horrible, this is, a lot of people, this is great. Last Wednesday, you had the U.S. Court of International Trade ruling that Trump had overstepped his authority by imposing his tariffs across the board. The next day, you had U.S. District Judge Rudolph Contreras. He ruled in favor of two toy companies that sued Trump over the tariffs, basically saying the same thing as the U.S. Court of International Trade. By Friday, an appeals court, I guess, had temporarily delayed or stayed the international court's decision. Sunday, Trump goes all over saying, you know what, if he loses in court, economic ruination. Monday, the Trump administration appeals Contreras' decision. By today, who knows? It has been back and forth, and all it has been the true sign of anything that Donald Trump puts his name on, and that is chaos. That is a dumpster fire, and here to help us weed through the dumpster chaos, I've asked Ryan Mulholland to come talk with us. Ryan's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on international economic policy. Ryan, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, great to be back. Good to see you again.
So I know things may have changed by now. I mean, the whiplash back and forth of tariffs, no tariffs, high tariffs, no tariffs, low tariffs. Where are we?
That's a very good question. Listen, you're absolutely right. Last week was a big week in terms of back and forth on the legal side. The judicial system sort of checking Trump. There is a stay on the Court of International Trade's decision, sort of ruling against Trump's use of emergency authority. I think that there's a couple of things that your listeners should know. One is that what Trump used to impose his Liberation Day, hope you feel liberated, tariffs, was emergency authority, which has never been used for tariffs before. So we have had tariffs in this country for a long time on lots of different things. There are very specific processes in place to justify those tariffs. You have to demonstrate that there is a national security harm to imports. You have to prove that another country is doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and you're going to use tariffs to stop them. There's anti-competitive behavior, and we have a whole caseload of anti-dumping countervailing duties to stop our workers from being screwed by the non-market practices of others. That was not what was determined to be illegal by the Court of International Trade. What was Trump claiming that he needed emergency authority and place whatever tariffs he wanted to whatever level to last as long as he could at his own discretion put in place. And so they said, no, that's not what the statute does. You don't have that authority. An appeals court has put a stay on that. It's likely that that appeal will move pretty quickly, and eventually this will end up at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You know, this is why we have rules in place. And with a Republican-controlled government, Republicans control the House, Republicans control the Senate, Republicans control the White House. They have all three branches of government. How hard would it have been to do this the right way so that we don't have the kind of chaos that we're seeing? Now, I understand. And look, you know, Trump is a chaos merchant. It's his stock in trade. But if you really believe in this policy and you control all the levers of government, it shouldn't be that difficult.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. But it brings up something that I think is important here, and that is that Trump's inner circle is not consistent on tariffs. There are some folks in the inner circle who view tariffs as a way of reshoring manufacturing. I am all for that. That is 100% what we should be doing. We should be bringing manufacturing jobs back to this country. 100%. There is another set, and I think Trump is in this category himself, where they actually don't really care too much about that. What they want to do is use tariff threats to extract things of value to them, right? They don't really care about bringing jobs back to this country. They want to threaten tariffs and get country X to do something about immigration or about buying more F-35s or giving Trump an airplane. And so that is what they use this emergency authority for, because they don't have to go through a process. They can just threaten on Twitter overnight that Trump's going to place 50% tariffs on this unless he gets what he wants. That's what the court said is not legal, right? I will also note that there's a third camp that wants to use tariffs to raise revenue to pay for tax cuts. And those things don't always work together, but that it's interesting to see that evolve over time.
Right. Now, this is where, you know, tariffs do can raise prices, and this would be another massive redistribution of wealth. And I'm not in that camp. I'm in the first camp. I think you can use tariffs strategically to protect domestic industries, especially steel and aluminum and auto production and things that we need to survive and have jobs and have products. But the other two, not so much.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what you're seeing is if you actually cared about bringing jobs back to this kind of creating manufacturing, sustaining manufacturing, you would have targeted strategic tariffs, and then you would backstop those with real investments, right? You'd have procurement policies that support Buy America. That's not what this administration is doing, right? They're actually pulling back investments in American manufacturing by gutting the IRA, for example. They're pulling back on investments. They're questioning whether we should be producing semiconductors and whether the CHIPS Act is a way to do that. So that this is not at all, and I want to be really clear, the Trump administration is not pursuing a strategy that will reshore manufacturing. They are using tariffs in a way to make the president feel powerful and be able to extract concessions from other countries.
And of course, gifts for, you know, the in-laws and the kids because they need jobs, all of that stuff. But you said something at the beginning, you know, and you talked about how tariffs can work and how the process at which you should go by proving that other countries have done things. There's a line of those. And I've often argued, why haven't we gone and pursued, let's just throw it out there, China, for instance. We know China is a mercantilist country. We know that they cheated every opportunity for years. It was about currency manipulation. It was about intellectual property theft. It was about closing off their markets. There's a lot of stuff we could have pursued with China being the goal. And look, maybe gotten the rest of the world on board with, but that actually takes some bit of strategy and thought process, whereas, you know, Trump's career has been all about chaos.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And let's face it, I mean, China has not been a good actor in trade. Their non-market practices have hurt us. They've also hurt our partners and allies around the world, right? It is not an American challenge, it's a global challenge. And the way to combat that is to work with kind of like-minded partners. The fact that we're putting huge tariffs on, you know, Canada, we're threatening 50% tariffs on the EU, makes it harder for us to put together that coalition that could actually make a difference on the China competitive front.
Now, the reason I bring this up, Ryan, is look, a lot of my Red Hat friends, like me, watched deindustrialization happen right before our eyes. They lost jobs. They lost, you know, opportunities. Communities are broken. There's a lot of bad that has happened because of our horrible trade policies. And the fact that our government hasn't really, in my view, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, hasn't really stood up for the working class of this country. We've done a nice job of protecting shareholders and maximizing shareholder wealth. But when it comes to putting food on the table for working class families, nobody's been great at that. But I look at this what we're doing now as the worst possible option. But you got folks out there, Ryan, who are going, hey, nobody else has done anything. At least he's trying, even if he's doing it wrong. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I will give you the beginning of that, because I think you're right. I think we've gone a long time with trade policies that have not put working people first. And the impact of that is very real. You know, in my home state of Wisconsin, there are a lot of communities that were devastated by the plant closing. And a lot of times those plant closures were because of poor trade policies. But I think the point that needs to be made is that Trump's alternative to what was is not the only alternative, right? That there is a better way forward that is not chaotic, that is not impulsive, that is not nationalistic, and that actually sort of thinks about how are we rebuilding industries for the future, not bringing back the job that existed in the 1950s, but positioning our communities and our workers to compete effectively and win, frankly, in international markets going forward. And what Trump is doing, yes, it's blowing up what was, but it's actually not bringing us closer to that solution that's good for the average person, bringing prosperity to working class people and their families. We're actually getting further away from that in a lot of situations, because of the impulsivity of his actions. I mean, I think it's not a coincidence that you're seeing hiring freezes, investment freezes, because if people don't know what the trade rules are going to be this afternoon, much less 3 years from now, 5 years from now, it's hard to put money into things. It's hard to hire people. It's hard to build new factories. And that's the impact of Trump's chaos.
But Ryan, didn't Trump say he brought, well, $5 gazillion back, $5 trillion from the Middle East? Wasn't there some just outrageous number that nobody could actually put out on paper? It just seems like a nice number pulled out of a certain orifice. But hey, he's brought all this back. So what he's saying is different than what you're saying.
That is true. He is certainly saying something different than I'm saying, and I very much hope that there are gazillions of dollars flowing into the U.S. right now. I don't see it, but hopefully it happens.
No, look, I'm all in favor. If this magic works, if the magic beans grow, I'm not opposed to it, but I don't see the magic beans, and that's my problem in this. And again, it's not just this. It's been a history of not just chaos, but misstatements, mistruths. How's a better way of saying lie than just saying out-and-out bold-faced lie?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, the UK deal that the Trump administration announced is a good example of this, right? I mean, what was agreed to, previous administrations of both parties would have put out a press release acknowledging progress in negotiations. And instead, Trump had an Oval Office event where he talked about the greatest trade deal in the history of the world. Well, none of the particulars are finalized. I don't know. That's one way to do it, I guess. And certainly the stock market liked it. You know, the markets were up. I think what you're starting to see is investors look and say, I don't think there's a whole lot there, and not taking Trump at face value. And I think one of the things that the Trump administration is going to run up against is that once you break people's trust, it's hard to get it back, right? And you're seeing that with our trading partners around the world. I think you're going to see that with businesses where they're just not going to believe what Trump says anymore. And that's a pretty bad thing for our country's long-term leadership.
No, it's economic ruination, to use his words. But the reality is I'm still struck on that anyone believes anything that comes out of his mouth for years, because he has been... You know, the guy who tells you what you want. He's one of the greatest used car salesmen, I think, ever to walk the planet, because, you know, he could sell a woman in a white dress a ketchup popsicle while she's walking through the desert. My problem is I can't believe anyone believes anything that comes out of his mouth because of the long, long track record of broken promises and all of that.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you.
So I wanted to go real quick. I want to go back and finish up on this point, because I think the way forward is talking about what we should be doing as opposed to how bad he's boogering this up. And this gives Democrats, I think, an opportunity, maybe even some Republicans, to break with the Trump regime and start talking about what we should be doing. I thought Joe Biden was moving us in that direction. I thought the Biden policies, especially on the chips, were moving us slowly, not as fast as I would like to go, or I know a lot of other folks, but slowly moving us in a direction to become competitive in the manufacturing sector again. How bad is that broken, I guess? And is there a way to go back in that direction? Because, look, everything that Biden evidently did was bad. Trump is turning around, except up in Susquehanna County, just north of me, where they're building a bridge with the Infrastructure and Jobs Act that was passed under Biden's name. Trump took off Biden's name, put his own. So evidently his name is now because of that bridge. And again, back to what Republicans do better than Democrats. They lie.
Yeah, I mean, your point about kind of what is next and sort of learning from the Biden term, I think what we saw under Biden was that you can have success reorienting global production patterns, meaning moving production back to the U.S., with a combination of targeted strategic tariffs where they make sense and real investment, right? Whether it was through the infrastructure bill, whether it was through the IRA, whether it was through the CHIPS Act, when the government puts money on the table and it's backstopped by tariffs and it's backstopped by procurement and it's backstopped by regulation and it's backstopped by taxes, you're able to sort of put a package together that makes it more attractive to make things here than somewhere else. And unless we're going to do something like that, I don't see it happening. Yeah. Because what the Trump team has done is they see tariffs are the solution to every problem, right? But tariffs alone are not going to rebuild manufacturing in the way that we want or at the speed that we want. Tariffs are a defensive tool. They're meant to stop bad things from coming into your market. Bad things meaning unfair things, illegal things, non-market things, and make sure that your domestic producers can compete on level terms. But if you actually want to grow industries, that takes more than defense. You got to play offense, and offense comes with real investment.
No, I'm right there with you. And also, you know, for me, tariffs are a part of a national security apparatus. There are certain things that we have to produce. I'm sorry, but, you know, having the magnets that make our smart bombs smart being made in China, I don't know. I don't know that that's a great national security position to be in, going, hey, we want to bomb you, but we don't have any magnets to come get you. Can you send us some so we can send them back? I don't know that that flies. Just throwing it out. But, Ryan, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Rick. Good to talk to you.
Ryan Mulholland, see you and your fellow there at the Center for American Progress. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Want to hear your thoughts. Is Trump right? Will there be economic ruination if he doesn't get to wield his tool? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, Wausau's home for Matt Nair on Air.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy tonight, showers and even a few thunderstorms. Areas of smoke as well. Lows in the low 50s. Hazy sunshine from some of the smoky areas for tomorrow. Highs mid-70s. Turning mostly sunny Thursday, high again upper 70s. Currently 57 degrees.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
This is for people who watched me anchoring the news at Channel 13. My last day at TV 13 was 20 years ago yesterday.
Oh, I'm old now too.
Well, yeah, that was my whole point.
And I was too when you stopped working at TV.
That's what I get all the time now is people come up and they go, oh, were you on TV? I'm like, yeah. And then I go, don't say it. I watched you when I was a little kid. I'm like, yikes.
Catch Mornings with Pat Kreitlow at its new time, weekdays 6 to 9 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, reliving history, and they say, you know, every 100 years, history repeats itself. And, well, not quite 100 years, but back in 1932, you had tens of thousands of World War I vets descending on Washington, D.C., marching across this country to converge in D.C. In the summer of 32. The bonus army saying, hey, we want jobs. We want our bonuses that we were promised. We want what you promised us to go and fight for this country, to put our lives on the line. We want what you promised. And oddly enough, again, budget cuts. Sorry, we can't afford to, you know, help you guys. Thanks, you're heroes, but, you know. So here we are, 2025, on June 6th, kind of the same thing. Veterans from across the country going to converge on Washington, D.C. and say, hey, help us out here. And here to share some thoughts on the big rally on June 6th, I've asked my good friend Will Adig to come talk with us. Will's the executive director of the Union Veterans Council. You can check out their website, unionveterans.org. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
No, anytime, Rick. I really appreciate that. And you know, one, anytime I get to tell the story of the Bonus Army, which I think is one of the most overlooked socioeconomic struggles in American history that kind of gets overlooked from both sides of the aisle, I really want to do that. So it's really, really exciting, you know, almost, you know, 90 years later. It's time that we show people that we're able to mobilize and fight for what we fought for throughout generations. I think a lot of times people look at the veterans community and you see the yellow stickers on the back of cars, right? We support troops at every single football game, but the reality of it is veterans have had to fight every single generation for everything we have, whether it's our healthcare, our earned benefits like GI Bill loans and the GI Bill so we can go to school. All these things have been fought for from either people in our past or individual advocates, even including kind of the Union Veterans Council who's had the fight for burn pit veterans right now. And we've had to do a lot of advocacy the last few years to make sure that we have healthcare for our veterans as they grow old. Because we're not getting any younger, yeah. Rick. You know, the first time I went to Iraq, I was 18. I think it was 2004, early 2004. That was a pretty long time ago. And the reality of it, we're getting older and we're going to have to rely on these promises that were made to us. And we're rallying June 6th. It's the Unite for Veterans, Unite for America rally, to let everybody in Washington, D.C. know that if you start to play with our benefits, the things that you promised to give us after you sent us to war for 20 years, we're going to make some noise. We're going to let you know you're on notice and that we're going to keep coming back. And that's what we're going to do with a really fun rally, including, you know, one of our favorite bands, Dropkick Murphys, which I think is going to be really fun to be part of.
No, that's going to be awesome. I'm a huge fan of DKM. And I think, look, the reality is we have made promises. And I've been saying this for years. If we don't honor those promises of the people that we put on pedestals and called heroes of the past, who's going to step up in the future seeing what we've done? And, you know, when you went into Iraq, you know, one of the things I said back then was, look, I grew up at a time when we were dumping poor working class people back into our neighborhoods who came back from Vietnam and literally dumping them into our communities with horrible drug and alcohol problems, broken minds, broken bodies, and nothing there. And I'm like, you know, we made promises to those folks that we didn't keep. Let's not make that same mistake. But it appears to me, Will, it appears we're doing that.
Yeah. So I'll go back to the bonus army. And, you know, Herbert Hoover at the beginning, you know, as we started to fall into the Great Depression, he put together a team called the National Economic League. Not many people know about this, except some folks in the veterans community. And this was a group of billionaires and some former generals and like really highfalutin' folks that put together a plan to save, to make government efficiency. And just kind of very similar to this Elon Musk guy and Doge, right? We just saw he got sent packing. Well, they couldn't find that much savings because the government was actually pretty lean, but they did find veterans benefits. And that's what the Bonus Army March on Washington, D.C. for. You know, right now, today, fast forward, over the last 100 days, we've seen the veterans community in the crosshairs of either Doge or the kind of the future of funding and the way our government runs. You know, we have faced right now where, depending on what they've said on any given day, one of the largest layoffs of veterans in history could happen this year. Up to 250,000 veterans could be laid off if they get their, if they're able to lay off their millions of veteran or federal workers that they want to. That leads to massive loss in our community. These are veterans we don't have to worry about. They're succeeding. They've came home. They're working a second job, a second career in federal workforce. They're usually doing pretty well, but now we're about to, you know, we're people who just bought houses now can't pay their mortgages. People are having to put weddings on hold. And then there's the cruelty aspect of how badly these federal workers have been talked about. And I've spent the last, you know, 15 years of my life advocating for veterans, mostly to get jobs. And you know, I don't have to go to the federal government and teach them how to take the experience of being in the military and tell them to use that in the civilian hiring processes. It's a place for veterans to get great jobs. It's not handouts. We actually care about the skills they learn in the military. And now they're just being fired indiscriminately. And that's going to lead to, you know, we're looking at 83,000 cuts at the VA, you know, starting this month or next month. We know it's going to disrupt our benefits. So we're just trying to sound the alarm for Secretary Collins and every politician in Washington, D.C.
Now, what was that number again? Number of cuts at the VA? Because as I understand it,
80, the goal, and this is their goal, and it's stated on congressional record that the goal of the VA secretary is to cut 83,000 jobs.
83,000. Yeah. Now, as I understand, they were already something like 50,000 people short to meet the goals that they needed to adequately serve veterans. So we're talking about not just not hiring the 50,000 that you're short, but getting rid of an additional 83,000. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, exactly. That's the word. That's what they want to do. And that's what, again, what their stated goal is. And I'm not sure they haven't really looked into it too well. I mean, it's a number they put on a spreadsheet that looks good and it's going to save some money somewhere, I guess. Except it's going to cause, you know, veterans to have longer wait times. It's going to have disruptions in care. I mean, right now the work environment is so bad. We're losing doctors and nurses. We're already seeing the stories that are happening. That people, why would you put your future on the idea that you might have to get fired at any point in time in the next year or so. You know, we have VA employees that are living with all their personal belongings in boxes because at the start of the this attack on federal workers, you know, people were showing up and their cards weren't working and they had 10 minutes to get their personal gear out of these departments. It's cruel. But that's just one of the things. But we want to have a loud and very loud voice when we're doing this. We've got, you know, thousands of veterans coming from 50 states, all 50 states. We've got unions coming in from all over the country. Steelworkers, one of them, that bringing a bunch of folks in from all over the country. But we're going to have thousands of people on the mall. We're going to have a really good, you know, speakers rotation with veteran groups and veteran voices, along with the Dropkick Murphys. And again, our goal is to send a very loud message. That we're not going to be, we're not going to roll over. We're not going to let you guys talk about our benefits and our future without us saying we're going to have a say in it. And that's what I'm really proud of with this whole rally.
So with the comparison being to the bonus army, you know, is this, maybe we're talking about an encampment? Maybe we occupy DC and maybe make Trump do what the military of 32 had to do, which was come in and burn down the tents, Eisenhower and MacArthur, if I remember.
That's right. You know, that's one of the reasons why we don't know too much about the bonus army is because I think both sides kind of whitewashed it. We have the conservatives who really don't like what they did, which was they sent some heroes of American history that we haven't heard this part, but MacArthur, General Patton, even Eisenhower, you know, led troops, killed multiple veterans, clearing them out. You know, once they said they weren't going to pay that bonus, the veterans decided they weren't going to leave. And for one of the only times in U.S. history, mobilized soldiers, a cavalry charge, tanks rolled through the streets in an act of aggression against their fellow Americans. And that was veterans who just got done fighting World War One. But that moment led to, as they prepared for World War Two, FDR had to realize that they had to change the way we took care of veterans, that the old ways are gone. You know, veterans have never been taken care of historically. We can go back to the time of Romans. Right. Veterans were never truly taken care of. That led to this promise, this compact that was made with veterans going into World War II that's kind of carried on. And that's that we're going to take care of you. So, you know, I believe right now this event's about America doing the math. Right. We're not going to be yelling at people. We're not giving people the ability to close their ears. They're going to have to listen to our veterans' voices. We're not going to be saying words that shut ears. We're going to be talking about the issues and the facts. And we want Americans to do the math. And we want these folks to know that we can mobilize when we want to. When we want to turn this switch on, it just takes a group of, you know, a group of 10 or 15, you know, eager veterans to start planning a command post. And we can put people on the mall. We can put people in Washington, D.C. And again, if they want to continue with these attacks on us, that we'll be back. And maybe the next time we'll be back for a little bit longer than just an afternoon on a Friday in late spring.
No, look, you know, getting people into the streets, I've been saying for the longest time, you know, the answers to our problems are going to be in the suffering caused by their savagery. And these are organizing opportunities to bring people together face to face to talk to each other. And that's my hope out of this. Look, bad things are going to happen. This administration doesn't care about working people. They've been very clear about that. You look at their budget. Look at what they've put on paper. You talk about budgets being moral documents. Sorry. Slashing and burning health care for some 5 million people, taking food out of the mouths of children. I don't know. It seems immoral to me. And doing what they're doing to the VA, right there at the top of that list.
Yeah, you know, the next weekend, you know, Trump is going to be having a big parade here in Washington, D.C., a military parade the weekend after our rally. And there'll be, you know, tanks, and it's going to cost upwards of almost $100 million when everything's said and done. That money could go to certain things. We know that there's tens of thousands of active duty service members rely on SNAP and Medicare, Medicaid because of the situations they're in. We know that many veterans who serve, you know, we have 31% of our veterans make less than $31,000 a year. They rely on Medicaid and SNAP and Medicare, these things. So, you know, there's a lot of attacks on our veterans community that we want to bring to the forefront. And, you know, I just want to mention one other thing. It's like, you know, we were really lucky that the Dropkick Murphys reached out to us, and they've got this, you know, tomorrow they're going to have a song release. I think, you know, it's going to be right before our rally, day before the rally. And it's going to talk about who stands with us. Like in this moment of time, who's standing with us as an American people?
So a modern day, which side are you on?
Very much so. But in a nice punk rock, Irish punk rock version. I've been lucky enough to see the video. And when the video comes out, it's an ode to the American, to the labor movement, to the people who are fighting every single day. It makes me proud to be an American and proud that I wore a uniform. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, when I think about my military service, I have my own opinions of it. I think we all do. We all get to have those things. But the reality of what we're doing today at this moment, like there's a fight for our democracy, Rick. And I really do mean that. And the only way for us to win is for regular everyday people to get more involved and get more engaged and not just do it on Twitter, not just do it on social media, but do it in a way in your community to get involved in civics. And one of the big goals of the follow on from this is our goal is to get more veterans engaged. You know, whether you're a union veteran or a Democratic veteran, there's programs for you. There's projects for you. If there isn't one, put together a team of veterans to get involved in your community. It does matter. It does matter. You know, and you know, this is going to be a patriotic celebration. We're going to have more American flag because I'm sick and tired of the other side owning these symbols. It's patriotic, Rick, to fight for SNAP and fight for Medicare, fight for veterans' health care and veterans' benefits. It's patriotic to fight for, you know, Americans who are here legally trying to just work to make a better life for themselves in a new country that we've been known for. My ancestors did when they came here. It's patriotic to do those things. And it's for too long, we've allowed them to hijack those words.
Yep.
You know, I remember one time going to a rally in 2018 in Washington, D.C., and I brought an American flag and I got yelled at from folks from my side. Like, why are you carrying that flag of oppression? The idea of the American flag is a guidon. And it's something to be looked at. It's not saying that we're perfect. A guidon leads the way. I look to that flag every single day. How can I make my country a little bit better? We haven't been perfect in the past. But what I'm really terrified of is if we don't fight and we don't fight the enemy that's in front of us, that all the enemies standing behind this wall that they have right now are going to come and get us. So we've got to fight with all the tools we have in our democracy right now against this really, really serious attack on our democracy that's happening right now, especially over the last 100 days.
And the start of it is on June 6th, the rally with America's veterans, National Mall in D.C. If you can't get to D.C., can you participate via the internet? Are you streaming this? Are there other ways to participate?
First and foremost, if you're interested in going to this or just getting more information, go to uniteforveterans.org, unite4vets.org. You can look that up. You can live stream this. We have links on there for live streaming. Valor Media will be live streaming it. I think it'll also be live streamed on Midas Touch. Any other place that wants to do that. We're recommending folks, if they can't come to DC, to do a watch party if they can, or just use it, share the information, watch it while it's on. It's going to be a good event. This is not just going to be a boring event with, you know, politicians talking one after another. It's a really well put together, couple hours of your day. That we hope to send a really good message.
Unite4veterans.org, the website. We'll get links out. Will, I appreciate the time. I look forward to having you back again. I'm sure this isn't going to be the end of it. So I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Definitely. Hey, thanks for being on our side and standing with us, brother.
I'm right there with you. Will Adick, Executive Director of the Union Veterans Council of the AFL-CIO. Check out their website, unionveterans.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at their work. And hey, if you're a veteran, maybe join up, especially if you're a union member. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1900. That was the day that the International Lady Garment Workers Union was formed in New York City by 7 local unions. While men held nearly all of the leadership roles in the early days of the union, most of the workers were Jewish women. One woman who rose through the ranks of the union's leadership was Fania Kohn. She was a Russian Jewish immigrant who worked as a sleeve maker. She helped to organize an ILGWU local at her workplace in New York. By 1916, she was elected as a vice president for the union. She was the first woman to hold that position. She made labor education programs her top priority, helping to found a workers' university at Washington Irving High School. Distinguished professors visited and gave lectures. In 1920, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics called the school, quote, the first systematic scheme of education undertaken by organized labor in the United States. Fania expanded her educational efforts on the East Coast from Boston to Philadelphia and to the West as far as Cleveland and Chicago. In 1919, 800 members had taken part in one of the courses. Classes included subjects such as public speaking, health, and literacy. Fania helped to found the Brookwood Labor College in New York, the first residential workers' college in the United States. Fania often met with obstacles within her union. She believed workers deserved a broad education that included stimulating culture and intellectual content. Many of the male leaders in the union wanted more narrow education focused on union matters. Despite this opposition, the ILGWU became an important force for social justice unionism within the United States labor movement. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So some good news coming out of Iowa. Joni Ernst, you remember over the weekend, said, well, you know, we're all going to die, when responding to a constituent saying, hey, you know, I got concerns about these Medicaid cuts. People are going to die. Well, I guess we're all going to die. So basically screw you if you're not wealthy enough or aren't fortunate enough to have insurance. And this has gotten a lot of attention and, you know, good attention, to be honest, because maybe people are finally waking up to the reality that these people don't care about you or me. And also the good news yesterday, my good friend, Democratic State Representative J.D. Scholten, who we've had on the program numerous times over the years, he's now launched his campaign to run against her. And good, we need somebody, a working class hero, to get in there and well, make the Senate a little younger, a little more activist, and a little bit more working class. And J.D. would be, I think, a fabulous, fabulous choice from Iowa. Nobody loves that state like in my view, like J.D. Scholten does. So I'm looking forward to getting him on the program. We're working on that, but I would love to see it. And here's the thing. You know, we just talked with Will Adig about the big rally coming up on Friday. And, you know, it got me thinking about the Bonus Army, that march back in 1932, how history just continually seems to repeat itself. And it's one of those chapters in working class history that you learn very little about. And there have been some of these in the past where working people have finally had it and they demand redress of their grievances to their government, only to have government, well, crush it. But this story really highlights kind of a situation where we're in today. The Great Depression, completely different time, but mass suffering and struggles. A working class that was having a really difficult time putting food on the table, making ends meet, keeping a roof over their heads. And, you know, in the heart of this economic depression, in the heart of this struggle, you had workers who were said, we've had enough and we want our government to do something. You know, it's like we talked about yesterday with that CNN poll where people going, look, I don't think either party can do anything, but we want our government to do something. We want government to solve problems. We want government to be activists. And this is a big deal because maybe this will give Democrats the opportunity to get off their duffs and do something. But remembering the history of the Bonus Army is, I think, a really important kind of thing. And I'm glad they're making the connection. Because you had millions of workers, veterans, who faced unprecedented hardships due to widespread economic catastrophe. You know, the economy had basically collapsed because rich people, you know, the people who know what to do, they blew it up. So, you know, in the context that we're looking at now, the Bonus Army is really something to look back to because it was a powerful symbol of working class frustration and the demand for relief, for help. Now, they were mostly World War I vets, mostly men. They were promised additional compensation. If they went and fought in World War I, they'd get a little bit something. That was going to be paid in 1945. But understand, 1932, you're worried about if you're going to put food on the table, if you're going to make it to tomorrow. The economy is in such shambles. You're going, hey, I need help now. So they started demanding, hey, we want some payment now. Do something. And they organized these marches and protests around the country and converged on Washington, D.C. in the hopes that they would get Congress to, I don't know, do something. And what did the president do? Well, send in the military to burn their tents and crush their occupation, which something Trump would love to do. Now, from a working class perspective, understand the Bonus Army reflected the widespread anger of ordinary working class Americans who felt betrayed by a government that had turned their back on them, but in favor of the very wealthy. Does that sound familiar? And what you saw were veterans and their families, unemployed, struggling. They saw these bonuses as a lifeline to help them get through and demanded recognition for their sacrifices just to survive. Now, you also had Hoover and his billionaire buddies who were trying to figure out how to take it away entirely. So there was that. But the march wasn't really just about money. It was about basic dignity and respect and the right to have a reasonable existence, basic security. And Will's right. You know, FDR took this and used it in a way to say, look, there should be the four freedoms. The freedom from want, the freedom from fear, the freedom from hunger, from those basic dignities that I think we should take for granted. Now, like I said, you know, the response from our government at the time, a conservative government, was brutal and dismissive. Hoover and Congress viewed the veterans as a potential threat. You know, they're breaking law and order. So instead of listening, what'd they do? They sent in the military. Douglas MacArthur, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Patton, rolled in with their tanks, the people on cavalry on horses, and, you know, forcibly removed the veterans, destroyed their encampments, burned their tents. The violence was shocking. You know, many of the veterans and their families were injured. And then you had these images of our heroes being attacked by troops, unarmed veterans being attacked by our military. So when someone says to me, well, that could never happen. History, my friends. And again, what did this suppression signify? Well, it showed that government didn't care. And it hurt Hoover badly. And it deepened the class divide, which I think we're in that moment. And which helped us get to an FDR, a New Deal. And this is where, you know, someone, you know, said not too long ago, you know, we had to go through Hoover to get to FDR. Maybe we have to go through Trump to get a new Deal. And because after FDR and the New Deal, what we had was a prosperous working class. What the Bonus Army ignited was some unity in coming together, this idea that we can fight for better. And look, the Bonus Army is a powerful reminder, a powerful symbol of resistance against economic injustice, government indifference, that workers can come together and unite. That the old adage, if I could pay half the working class to murder the other half, can be overcome. So I'm telling you, if you can, unite the number 4veterans.org. Watch the rally on Friday. If you're in D.C. or near D.C., get there. I think this could be one of those things you tell your grandchildren about. You know, I was there when the next push towards a working class revival happened. We're going to see. But I want to hear your thoughts. Did you learn about the Bonus Army in school? Are you just now hearing about it for the first time? I sure hope not. but you should look into it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Feds now have in custody the wife and five children of the man accused of a fiery Molotov cocktail attack in Boulder, Colorado. The latest from CBS's Matt Piper.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem made the announcement on X.
Today, the Department of Homeland Security and ICE are taking the family of suspected Boulder, Colorado terrorist and illegal alien Mohammed Soleiman into ICE custody.
She says while he will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law,
we're also investigating to what extent his family knew about this horrific attack, if they had any knowledge of it, or if they provided support.
DHS says Soleiman's wife and five children will now be processed under expedited removal, which allows the government to deport migrants in the U.S. illegally without a court hearing. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Soleiman is due in court on Thursday in Colorado, and there is a federal court hearing scheduled for Friday. Under directions from the defense